Iran and Qatar pledge to expand bilateral cooperation as President Raisi pays an official visit to Doha. Iran criticizes a lockup result by the West to make necessary political decisions in the Vienna negotiations to remove anti-Tehran sanctions. Situation escalating on the Ukraine-Russia border. Moscow says a shell from Ukrainian territory has completely destroyed a border guard post in Russian Rostov region. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafieh. Good to have you with us. Top story, Iranian president is in the Qatari capital, Doha, on a two-day state visit. Ebrahim Raisi says that his administration is trying to expand cooperation with the Persian Gulf Arab nation. Raisi was speaking in a news conference with the Qatari emir. Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani also said that Doha wants to promote bilateral ties with Tehran. The two countries have signed more than a dozen agreements and memorandum of understanding on Tuesday. Iranian president will address the sixth summit of the Gas Exporting Countries Forum in Doha. This is Raisi's first visit to a Persian Gulf neighbor since becoming president in June last year. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman is critical of the lack of result by the Western side in the talks to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA.
If we see some actual commitments in the other side on these few remaining issues, we will be able to enter the phase to finalize the agreement. But until we reach that stage, the other side must take tough and serious steps. We're still waiting for the US and Europe to make the needed decisions, and we haven't yet seen the determination in them to make those decisions.
Said Khatibzadeh says the Iranian team won't compromise on the rights and interests of the nation. He urged European leaders to focus on the negotiations at hand, show some initiative and flexibility, and avoid making political statements or raising issues unrelated to the JCPOA. Also Monday, Iran's top security officials said that the talks between Iran and the signatories to the deal will continue until a result is achieved. According to Ali Shamkhani, negotiating with the U.S. is not on the agenda of the Iranian delegation because, as he puts it, such talks will not be the source of any progress. Iran has hosted an online conference on the slain Iranian military commander, Lieutenant General Soleimani. The general was assassinated in a U.S. airstrike in Iraq in 2020. Yusuf Jalali reports.
It's the third edition of the annual conference on Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, dubbed General Soleimani and New Islamic Civilization. The conference was held online this time, with 50 scholars and political pundits from across the world giving speeches.
General Qasem Soleimani is a martyr. And he died fighting the head choppers and the throat slitters. And a brave, a charismatic leader. And we all honor his life.
General Soleimani was the spearhead of the fight against terrorism and the guarantor of regional stability. Should Iran and Russia have sat on their hands and not defeated the terrorists in Syria and Iraq, they would have had to fight them in their own soils.
We know that the U.S. and some other countries used terrorism under the banner of religion to topple the Syrian government and move the battlefield to Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, and the entire region. But Soleimani shattered all the U.S.'s calculations.
Soleimani was the commander of IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations.
The security of the Zionist regime is an important issue for all of the American governments. What General Soleimani did was to put Palestine in top of the Muslim world's priorities. And then he gathered and united all of the groups that opposed Israeli occupation as the resistance axis. This was the major motive for the U.S. to assassinate him.
Iran and Iraq have set up joint investigation committee on General Soleimani's assassination. Based on the latest findings of the legal team, 120 people have been identified in connection with Soleimani's assassination. Former U.S. President Donald Trump tops the list.
Iranian and Iraqi judicial teams are seriously following up on a legal pursuit to bring the culprits to justice. Iraq is where the assassination took place and has so far kept close cooperation with Iran. In the four-day conference, we're also going to discuss legal dimensions of Soleimani's assassination.
General Soleimani holds a reputation for eliminating Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that led to the recapturing of key areas from Daesh. That's why his assassination is viewed as a huge loss for the region and a big win for the terrorists.
General Soleimani's assassination gave a clear clue about who is who in the fight against terrorism in the region. The United States killed the nemesis of Daesh, and that puts Washington on the terrorists' team. This as Iran is firmly following up on its legal pursuit to bring the perpetrators to justice, saying this is to make sure that such incidents will not happen again against Iranian military figures. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Saudi warplanes have launched fresh air raids on residential areas in Yemen, killing one person and wounding 10 others. Fighter jets hit a house in the town of Abs in northwestern Hejaz province. Ansar movement condemned the air raids, saying that the attacks against civilians amount to war crimes and terrorism. Riyadh and some of its allies launched a war on Yemen in March 2015, devastating the country's key infrastructure. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed in the assaults. Millions more have been displaced, while half of the population is facing hunger due to an air, land, and sea blockade. The UN says Yemen is the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. In the meantime, according to the Yemeni army, the forces have thwarted an attack by the Saudi-led coalition on the strategic city of Harat, inflicting heavy losses on the enemy. Army spokesman Yahya Sariyat denied allegations that a Saudi-led coalition had taken control of the northwestern city in Hejaz Governorate. The army says a mountainous area was also liberated. Some 200 Saudi forces and mercenaries were killed, and almost double that number were injured. The army added that over 40 armored and military vehicles were also destroyed, and two spy drones were shot down. The army is confronting the Saudi-led coalition forces and their loyalists on several fronts inside Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali in Sana tells us about the goals behind the army operations in different parts of Yemen. He also explains why the Saudi-led coalition is fighting the Yemeni army in the city of Harat.
The Yemeni army is only defending the Yemeni lands, but now they are advancing to Saudi territories and taking control of new Saudi territories. The Yemeni army says these areas are actually our Yemeni territories, and the Riyadh agreement, the Al-Taif agreement, which was assigned decades ago, it will now be reconsidered by the Yemeni government to see which lands are belonging to the Yemeni people. The Yemeni army is only defending the Yemeni lands. They did not escalate the operations in Harada, but it was escalated by the Saudi coalition forces, maybe to push the Yemeni army to stop attacking Marib. The Yemeni army is determined to liberate the city of Marib. They are encircling now the city, and they have been encircling the city for a few months now, but you know that they didn't want to attack the civilians inside the city. They want only to force the forces inside the city to leave.
The UN denounces the Israeli regime for planning to evict Palestinian families from their ancestral homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the occupied Al-Quds. Stephane Dujarric, a spokesman for UN Secretary General, slammed the move as a violation of international law. He says that the UN has repeatedly called for an end to the forced eviction and destruction of homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. The UN official urged Tel Aviv to adopt necessary measures to protect civilians, including Palestinian refugees. He made a comment after a UN delegation visited the occupied Palestinian territories. Sheikh Jarrah has been a flashpoint, witnessing crackdowns by Israeli forces on Palestinians protesting the expulsion of dozens of families in favor of Israeli settlers. Tensions along the Russian border with Ukraine escalating. Moscow says a shell fired from Ukraine has destroyed a border facility used by the Russian Border Guard Service. The incident happened in the Rostov region, 150 meters from the two-country joint border. No casualties have been reported. Sporadic shelling across the line dividing Ukrainian government troops and pro-Russian forces in the east has intensified since last week. On Sunday, pro-Russia groups in eastern Ukraine said government troops shelled the Flashpoint region, killing two civilians. In recent days, thousands of residents from Donetsk region have been evacuated amid fears of an imminent attack by the Ukrainian government forces. The evacuees are being accommodated in southwestern Russian cities. The U.S. signaling its readiness for a diplomatic solution to stand up with Russia over Ukraine while wielding the threat of sanctions against Moscow. The White House says that President Biden has accepted, in principle, to meet with his Russian counterpart, but only if Russia has not invaded Ukraine by then. President Emmanuel Macron of France had pitched the idea of a summit on security and strategic stability in Europe to both leaders. The Paris says that Putin has also agreed in principle to the meeting. The U.S. and its allies accuse Russia of planning an invasion of Ukraine, a charge that Moscow denies. Washington says if Moscow does attack, it will be targeted with swift and unprecedented sanctions. The White House has even prepared an initial package of sanctions that includes barring U.S. financial institutions from processing transactions for major Russian banks.
World leaders participated in the 58th Munich Security Conference in Germany, which is held annually. This year's conference was dominated by the Ukraine crisis, as major Western powers accused the Kremlin of zeroing in on an imminent invasion of Ukraine. In the conference, the U.S. Vice President, Kamala Harris, announced that Washington and its allies will impose significant and unprecedented economic costs on Russia if it further invades Ukraine.
We will impose far-reaching financial sanctions and export controls. We will target Russia's financial institutions and key industries.
Harris also added the U.S. will not stop with economic measures, but will further reinforce the eastern flank of NATO. Harris said some 6,000 additional service members are already deployed to Romania, Poland, and Germany. The official also noted that some 8,500 troops in the United States are on high alert. Also, another high-profile attendee in the 2022 Munich Security Conference, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, said Britain could block Russian companies from raising capital in London and has passed legislation to widen sanctions on Russian businesses and individuals if the country invades Ukraine. Johnson also stated that Russia would pay a heavy military price if it invaded Ukraine. Britain has already sent hundreds of troops to Poland to support NATO's eastern flank. However, the chairman of the Munich Security Conference, Wolfgang Eisinger, has highlighted the need for dialogue to resolve the differences. He said our world is in danger, traditional certainties are crumbling, threats and vulnerabilities are multiplying, and the rules-based order is increasingly under attack. He noted that the need for dialogue has never been greater. Meanwhile, Russia has time and again denied any intention to invade its western neighbor. It argues that it's deployed the military near Ukraine's borders to protect itself amid NATO's eastward expansion. Also, in a major step toward de-escalation, last week Moscow withdrew some of its troops near the Ukrainian border after completing military exercises.
The U.S. president has said again that Russia could invade Ukraine within days. Biden has warned in case a war happens, it'll close the window for diplomacy. Washington has even gone as far as stating that Russia may use a false flag attack to create a pretext for invasion. But both Ukraine and Germany toned down the rhetoric at the Munich Security Conference and advised against hyping up the crisis. All this brings into question the U.S. motives for pushing the narrative on a Russian invasion.
The U.S. President Joe Biden has ramped up his rhetoric against Russia amid mounting tension in Eastern Europe. He once again repeated his claim that Washington had intelligence showing his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, has made up his mind to invade Ukraine.
We have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days. We believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people.
Speaking at the White House, Biden warned that war will close the window for diplomacy with Moscow. Biden also said Western countries won't deploy troops in Ukraine, but will continue to bolster their defensive capabilities. Earlier, the White House said Washington and its allies are working on a sanctions package in case of a Russian invasion. This is while Italy says the bans should not target energy imports from Russia. This could throw the EU economy into mayhem or even negatively affect Russia's gas supplies to Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Nearly 38% of Russia's exports went to the EU, while over 36% of Russia's imports came from Europe. Russia is also the origin of 26% of EU's oil imports and 40% of EU's gas imports.
I don't think Russia cares so much and worries so much about Western sanctions, because Russia proved for the years, in spite of Western pressure and different sanctions, capable to sustain and even improving slowly, not so good as before, its economy. So sanctions are not the main threat to Russia.
The U.S. accuses Russia of planning an attack on Ukraine, but Moscow says that is not true. Therefore, the latest warnings, based on unfounded accusations that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is just around the corner, would further complicate the situation at this critical time.
Now, in the United States, the mayor of New York City is facing a backlash after announcing a plan to ban homeless people from entering subways. The Coalition for the Homeless, the advocacy group, hit back at Eric Adams' plan, dismissing it as a repeat of failed strategies. The group says it was sickening that the mayor would use terms like cancer to refer to the homeless. The reaction came after Adams announced a crackdown on homeless people sheltering in a subway. Under the plan, he said that the steps would be taken to cleanse the city's subways of homeless who use them as a place to sleep, panhandle, or threaten passengers. The announcement has drawn the ire of homeless advocates and others who believe a heavy-handed approach won't solve the problem. Atlantic storm Eunice has battered northwestern Europe. It hit western England Friday, powering its way all the way to London, killing more than a dozen people and leaving behind a trail of destruction. The storm has dissipated and a cleanup operation is underway. It's fueled a debate about the UK's resilience against such storms, though. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
As we clerics say, there is a room for degrees when it comes to who is revolutionary. It is possible that a person has better conduct when it comes to revolutionary concepts and activities, and that another person does not. But the latter is taking the same path. If we accuse any person who does not have the great and complete performance of being a non-revolutionary and anti-revolutionary, this is a mistake. It is possible that the value of a person's movement is 100% and the value of another individual's movement is less. But both are taking the same path. The important thing is that the movement should be in line with the revolutionary criteria. The important thing is criteria. The important thing is that even a person who does not move forward in a completely resolute manner should have revolutionary criteria. If these criteria exist, then that party is a revolutionary one, no matter if it is an individual, a group of individuals, or a government or organization. The main point is that we should know these criteria.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There are specific criteria for being a revolutionary. I'd like to mention five criteria during this meeting. Of course, more criteria can be mentioned, but for the moment, I will mention five criteria for being a revolutionary. We should try to have and preserve these criteria wherever we are. A person might work in art, another might work in an industry, another might work in politics, another might be involved in scientific activities, and yet another might be involved in economic and commercial activities. It does not make any difference. These criteria can exist in all Iranians. These are the five criteria which I will expand on later. A commitment to the main principles and values of the revolution, aiming at the ideals of the revolution and making great efforts to attain them. The commitment to the independence of the country in all areas, showing sensitivity in the face of the enemy and the enemy's plots. The fifth criterion is religious and political piety, which is very important.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is Mohammed. Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole.
In this special edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the row over the Muslim headscarf in the southern Indian state of Karnataka and how it constitutes blatant violation of religious freedom. And we shall also look at the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party anti-Muslim agenda and hideous attempts to fan the flames of communalism.
In the world's largest democracy, young Muslim women are fighting the biggest and most decisive battle of their lives. The ban on wearing hijab in schools in a southern Indian state has become a new flashpoint in the battle over rights of religious minorities in India, sparking global outcry. While Muslim students have stood their ground and refused to cave in, radical Hindu groups backed by the state have been resorting to extreme repressive measures to enforce the dicta.
The southern Indian state of Karnataka, governed by the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, has been rocked by protests in recent months over the ban on hijab in government-run schools. The controversy erupted last December at a girls' school in the city of Udupi when several hijab-clad Muslim students were denied entry into classrooms. The girls' students protested over what they believed was a violation of their right to religious freedom, guaranteed under Article 25 of the Indian Constitution. Since then, protests have spread to other cities in the southern Indian state as well as the national capital, New Delhi, as more schools have moved to implement a similar ban on the Islamic headscarf under the pressure of radical hate-mongering Hindu groups. Stung by growing protests, the government in Karnataka last week ordered closure of high schools and colleges in the state, and the matter reached the region's high court. Muslim girl students filed a petition to question how their hijab was disturbing equality, integrity, and law and order, on the basis of which the state government had banned them from the school. The court referred the matter to a bigger bench as it involves constitutional questions of personal law.
I think that the courts are, and I think that the courts have consistently in the past as well upheld religious freedoms, upheld what they believe is the, like I said, a standard essential religious practice. But I think that the difficulty that I personally am seeing in this particular debate is, I think that instead of handling the question sort of head on and saying that, well, it is not the job of the individual who is seeking the ban to explain why this is an essential religious practice. It is the job of the state to explain why it is curtailing the exercise of this freedom. And so what the Karnataka High Court has now done as an interim measure is to say that nobody can exercise any of their religious practices. And so in the interim, in order to uphold public order, the court has said that, well, you know, even Hindus can't wear shawls or Muslims, and therefore Muslim women can also not wear hijab. But I think what they are conflating is that, first of all, Hindus wearing shawls, you know, wearing saffron shawls, is not necessarily, at least from my understanding, a religious practice which they really felt the need to earlier exercise. I think it was a reaction to Muslim women wearing hijabs. So I think that by comparing the two of them and making them equal, the court may have made this a harder issue for itself to solve, because I think that the question is still very simple. The question is just, there are freedoms, and there are freedoms of equality, and then there are freedoms of religion. And unless there is an overwhelming public interest to curtail either of them, the courts must necessarily favor the right to exercise those freedoms.
Protests against what is being seen as a flagrant violation of religious freedom in the Democratic Republic of India have spread far and wide, causing Narendra Modi government in New Delhi a huge embarrassment. Amidst the chaos, a Muslim student from Kolkata has become a symbol of heroic fight against right-wing hooliganism and the BJP's government's anti-Muslim policies. Muskan Khan's viral video, in which she confronts a Hindu mob with thunderous chants of Allahu Akbar, has caught the imagination of well-meaning people across India and beyond.
On the cold, wintry morning of February the 8th, a young Muslim student, Muskan Khan, parked her bike outside her school in the southern Indian state of Karnataka. Wearing hijab as she scampered across the school grounds, a group of men sporting saffron scarves, clothing associated with right-wing Hindu groups, accosted her in an intimidating way. A viral video of the incident showed the mob heckling her and demanding that she take off her face and head coverings. They hollered Jai Shri Ram, a slogan of radical Hindu groups. In response, the brave girl, far from being intimidated, looked them in the eye and chanted Allahu Akbar while punching her fist in the air as a sign of protest. The video became viral on social media, provoking strong reactions from civil society, media, and Muslim groups in the country.
Every religion has a freedom. India is a unity. India is a unity, so every religion has a freedom.
I think it's extremely brave. And I think that, you know, women individually have been fighting this fight, and this is across the board, I think, especially women from minority religious communities in India. They've been fighting this fight on the individualized skin. And it started in Udupi much earlier in December itself in Karnataka, because some of these rules are completely new. There seems to be no reason why an educational institution has come up with this went for 30 odd years, you know, of course there are school uniforms and that's a whole other debate, but you know, large colleges do allow people to wear what they want to wear, subject to certain broad restrictions. So I think that this video of this girl confronting the vigilante, it's definitely extremely powerful. And I think that it opened up a lot of debates, it opened up older debates in India about really how hard it is for women across to exercise their rights, to feel enfranchised, to feel like they have a voice say in something that is happening very concretely to them. So I think definitely this is it's an important video, and it's an important memory for India to remember what women have faced on a basis to even be enforced something that is extremely basic and really universal at all.
The confrontation between the schoolgirl and the mob of Hindu zealots illustrates the deepening religious divide in India under the Narendra Modi-led BJP government and increasing vulnerability of religious minorities. The viral video has inspired an online pain in India, Muslim women reasserting their religious identity. The hashtag #HijabIsOurRight has been trending on Twitter, resonating with people across the world.
The controversy over hijab in India divided the nation among those who defend the ban and those who oppose it. Politicians and activists associated with the Hindu national government at the center and states have gone out of their way to support the ban on women's headscarf. On the other hand, some opposition parties, civil society groups and Muslim organizations have announced what they see as the blatant breach of India's constitution and fundamental rights.
The right-wing government in Karnataka last week issued a note in support of the school's ban on hijab. In a circular, it directed schools and colleges in the state to strictly enforce a uniform dress code. In response, one of the students filed a legal petition arguing that wearing the scarf was a fundamental right to religion guaranteed by the Indian constitution. The court will now have to decide hijab constitutes an essential religious practice and whether the ban is warranted.
It's an individual right. So practicing a religious belief or practicing on their heads, it's a individual right. So rights has to be prevailed. That's rights has been given to the students.
The opponents of the ban contend the issue, which pertains to freedom of conscience and free profession, practice and propagation of religion, enshrined in Article 25 of the institution. However, the government officials in Karnataka think otherwise.
In my college, when I joined it, they just told me that if you're wearing it, you can wear a hijab. Make sure it matches your uniform. We did that. Why, if right now they have this question, why did they allow us to wear it? If they did not had a problem from this, why did they allow us at one time? That's, you know, and moreover, it is not promoting our religion. This is our way to our pride, our modesty. It's just a way of us showing us that is our, you know, this is written in our religion. That is supposed to cover us. This is our pride. We wear it as telling it's a pride that, okay, you know, we are wearing hijab, you too start wearing it. We are not promoting and provoking everyone to wear. We are just wearing it because it's written in our religion.
Many political commentators see the hijab row as part of a sinister maneuver by the BJP government in New Delhi. Communal tensions at times when elections are underway to choose a new government in the country's most populous state, Uttar Pradesh. The northern instance is nearly 2,000 kilometers away from Karnataka. The hijab controversy is closely tied to the party's national electoral strategy. BJP long banked Islamophobic populism to win state elections.
The fault lines between the majority Hindu and minority Muslim community in the world's second most populous country have terrifyingly widened since the Hindu nationalist government came to power in 2014. The toxicity of hate and hostility to Muslims, who make up around 14% of the country's 1.4 billion population, threatens to tear apart the fabric of India's secular democracy. Latest row over observance of hijab, the Muslim headscarf, has to be seen in the context of state elections in Uttar Pradesh, the most populated and the most crucial state in the country, as well as next year's election in Karnataka. The frequent communal flare-ups in India in recent years have largely happened around election time and due to incitement from radical Hindu groups. Appealing to emotions of Hindu pride and invoking the imaginary fear of Islamic expansionism has won the right-wing BJP many state elections since 2014.
Over the last, about 7-8 years, we are increasingly seeing that conversations about religion, conversations about conservative political thoughts, etc., are taking the forefront more. I think 8-10 years back when we were growing up, I don't remember having this level of conversation continuously about religion, and I felt that there was definitely the idea of secularism was a very clear idea growing up, and it was very clear to us that the Indian constitution protected all religious freedoms. And I think now you're definitely seeing a shift in that, and I think that that's sort of across the board. That's across the board with whether there are elections happening, elections not happening, and I definitely think that that is something that we are seeing a lot. And I think it would be incorrect to say that this is happening to all religions, because it is not. And in fact, we were just looking up something that, there is, like I said, Sikhs are allowed to practice their religion.
Karnataka and South India and Uttar Pradesh and North India are tied by a convoluted umbilical cord, as both states are ruled by BJP. Karnataka has emerged as the new Hindutva laboratory in South India, while Uttar Pradesh has in recent years seen a rising number of anti-Muslim hate crimes. Experts say what happens in Karnataka is directly proportional to what happens in Uttar Pradesh and vice versa.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we're joined by Simi Pasha, an independent journalist from New Delhi. Welcome to the program, Simi. So as you know, the iron-fisted ban on hijab in schools in the southern Indian state of Karnataka has sparked global outcry. Do you think the ban makes mockery of the country's constitution?
Thank you so much for discussing this issue and speaking to me about it. As an Indian, it's actually deeply disturbing to witness the kind of scenes that we're seeing all over the country. It's not just down south now. There are several instances that have been reported in Uttar Pradesh and Madhya Pradesh as well, North Indian states and in central India. While the courts decide whether a ban on hijab is actually a violation of fundamental rights, in my opinion, it definitely is. It's contrary to the idea of freedom, constitutional right of freedom and equality. These are fundamental rights that the Constitution of India guarantees every citizen of the country. I beg your pardon. It's also a violation of cultural and educational rights. Article 29 of the Indian Constitution protects the rights of minorities, especially if these minority groups have their own separate culture or language or script. Article 29 of the Indian Constitution gives the minority group a right to preserve their culture and protects them by preventing the state from imposing an outside culture on them. So I think these articles, what we're seeing in Karnataka is a violation of fundamental rights. In my opinion, what the courts will be examining is whether the wearing of hijab is an essential practice under Islam, because there are two other articles of the Indian Constitution, Article 25 and 26, that allow freedom to practice any religion. So, for example, you have Sikhs in our country, people who practice Sikhism. They wear turbans on their head and they carry a kirpan, which is a small knife which they carry on them. This is allowed by the Constitution. Similarly, the courts will be examining whether wearing a hijab is an essential religious practice.
So, Simi, it started with one school, and now more schools have moved to implement a similar ban on hijab in Karnataka. Why is this piece of clothing making authorities so agitated?
So this ban on hijab has actually just come out of nowhere. We've been a secular democracy for more than 70 years. Muslim women in India have been wearing burqas and hijabs for as long as we remember. There's really no real reason. There's no reason what, nobody knows what prompted that school in Udupi, the Kundapur PU college, to issue a circular saying that girls wearing hijabs should not be allowed inside their schools. And, you know, on the 5th of February, which is 5 days before Uttar Pradesh went to polls, the state government issued an order saying that girls will not be allowed to wear hijabs because it's not part of their uniform. Now, interestingly, when the Karnataka state government issued this directive, it was imposing an already previous order that it had passed in 2013, which means almost from between 2013, when the rules were first passed, to 2022 now, almost 9 years that rule has not been implemented. 9 years later, and 5 years before Uttar Pradesh goes to polls, Karnataka decides to impose a ban on hijab, which according to it, it had passed in 2013. So the timing is really suspect, and it really makes one wonder what the motive behind this is. Interestingly, one little point I'd like to make. There's a video that surfaced of Bajrang Dal and Vishwa Hindu Parishad, right-wing groups, distributing saffron shawls to Hindu boys and asking them to protest against Muslim women who are wearing hijab. So there's that angle as well.
Some Muslim girl students have filed a petition challenging the unfair and unjust violations of their rights to religious freedom. Are courts independent enough to deliver justice?
Well, we do have utmost faith in our judicial system. And as an Indian Muslim, and as a member of an Indian society, Indian democracy, one of the world's largest democracy, I do believe that our courts will ensure that our fundamental rights are not trampled upon.
A viral video of a young Muslim student confronting a mob of Hindu vigilantes has created an international stir. How would you describe her act of resistance?
So we saw a video of this 19-year-old girl, Muskan, who shouted Allahu Akbar when she was being heckled, chased, harassed, humiliated by a group of 40 to 50 boys with saffron scarves around their necks, chanting Jai Shri Ram. If you see that video, it's actually bone-chilling because it's not just heckling and it's not just harassment on religious ground. There's also, you know, there's a threat of sexual violence as well. For that lonely girl to walk down that road from her scooter that she had parked, and she was walking inside school, it must have been a harrowing time. And for her to stand up and say Allahu Akbar, it's not just an act of resistance. I think it's an act of brevity. It's an act of courage. And in fact, in an interview to an Indian news organization, she said that for me, I said Allahu Akbar because it made me feel safe and it gave me courage. And as all Muslims, we call out to Allah when we feel unsafe or weak or under threat. And she said that's exactly what I did.
So the hijab row has virtually divided the country among those who defend the ban and those who oppose it. What's the position of opposition parties in India on this issue?
So opposition parties usually don't speak out against persecution of Muslims because they are wary of losing Hindu votes. But in this instance, they've been surprisingly vocal. Rahul Gandhi, who leads the Congress Party, which is the principal opposition party in the country, has put out several tweets supporting the girls who are wearing their hijab, fighting for their rights. His sister Priyanka Gandhi, who's also one of the vice presidents of the party, has also put out a tweet on Twitter saying that you cannot trample upon the rights of girls to wear whatever clothing they want to wear, whatever article of clothing that they choose to wear. There are other opposition parties as well who are also speaking out. But I think it's basically the Congress which has taken up the issue. The Trinamool Congress has also made some noise about it. But for once, it has come as a surprise to everyone that opposition parties are actually standing up and speaking out against persecution of Muslim girls. Because in this instance, it's also the right-wing Hindutva groups are trying to deprive Muslim girls of their basic right to receive an education, which is extremely worrying. Because everybody knows if you educate a girl, you educate a future family, and to deprive Muslim girls and education is basically an attempt to push Muslims into an abyss of poverty, unemployment, and economic backwardness.
There you have it. Simi, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Nobel laureate Malala Yousafzai slams the refusal to let hijab-clad girls inside schools in India as horrifying, urging the Indian government to end the marginalization of Muslim women. Asaduddin Owaisi, a senior Indian politician and lawmaker, hails the Muslim girl who bravely confronted a Hindu mob for her commitment to education and exercising her freedom of religion and choice. A Delhi University professor, Apurva Nand, says he is ashamed and outraged by the scenes in Karnataka where Muslim women are being forced to take off hijab, calls it against all norms of civility. Irene Akbar, a journalist and social media activist, notes that Islamophobes can't digest the idea of a religious and empowered Muslim woman, which is why they oppose hijab-clad girls seeking education. Former Jammu and Kashmir Chief Minister Omar Abdullah argues that individuals must be free to choose what to wear, adding that if BJP leaders can wear saffron robes, Muslim girls can also use hijab.
And that was our episode about the unchecked assault on religious freedom of Muslims in BJP-ruled India. We shall meet again next week.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to focus on the doubts and misconceptions posed by different questioners all around the world concerning the Islamic issues. The question that we are going to talk about today is about the importance and value and excellence of istighfar, repentance, at the months of Rajab and Sha'ban. For this, we have invited an Islamic scholar from Qom Seminary Schools to join us in this studio and answer our questions. I'd like to welcome Sheikh Nur Muhammad into this show and say salam to him, Sheikh. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to this show.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure for us to have you here, Sheikh. The question of the day that we need to ask it from respected guest, the speaker of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, is concerning the dreams that we see periodically. Sometimes we see some dreams and we see some of the beloved ones who passed away already. Who already passed away, and we see that they are sometimes happy, sometimes they are sad, and so they are sometimes in different situations and positions, in different situations and, let's say, different moods. We want to know about the reason for the sadness or happiness or strange mood of these people that we see in dreams, Sheikh. What is the reason? Is it due to the actions that we perform? That is, we did something good or bad and actually we are seeing the result of it in our dream with those people coming to our dreams to bring a message? Or no, it is due to their own activities while they were in this world. I mean, for example, if they were good people, I mean, we are seeing them happy. If they were bad people, we are seeing them sad. I would be grateful if you shed some light on that, Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for this valid question. You see that, first of all, we have in the verse of Noble Quran a couple of verses talking about having dreams.
Yeah.
And different kind of dreams that we have in the verse of Noble Quran and in the narrations. These are actually some of the dreams that we see in the, you know, verse of Noble Quran. They are included to the actually, they are considered to be from Ar-Ru'ya Sadaqa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ru'ya Sadaqa means actually accurate dreaming,
yeah.
Actually dream that you have. And of course, on the other hand, we have some kind of dreams or which are considered to be non-accurate,
mm-hmm.
Okay, which we call it in Quranic terminology, Adghathu Ahlam.
Mm-hmm.
Which means some false dreams.
Okay.
Okay, not accepted dreams.
How can we differentiate between them?
Of course, first of all, we have these two kinds of dreams,
yeah.
Okay, and these two sorts of dreams in the verse of Noble Quran.
Mm-hmm.
But about how can we distinguish whether our dreams was, for example, Ru'ya Sadaqa, accurate dreams, or mm-hmm. it was Adghath Ahlam, it was... for example, false dreams,
yeah.
We should consider the, actually conditions for the dreams. If you want to have accurate dreams, it have a lot of condition beside it.
Mm-hmm.
For example, about the, the etiquette of sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
You should consider the etiquette of the sleeping. And you, for example, one of the etiquette is to be in the state of purity.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, physically speaking, to have some kinds of ablution or, for example, a spiritual kind of purity, which to be away from committing any sins,
mm-hmm.
and to ask forgiveness from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And of course, it has some kind of some other condition for the dreams in order to be accurate one. And of course, I personally believe that very rarely we can have these kind of accurate dreams,
mm-hmm.
okay, very rarely happening.
So it's not that, for example, every time that we have a dream, it might be, for example, a Ru'ya Sadaqa, or a true dream, or always it might be, for example, Adghath Ahlam, that is a false dream.
For the most cases, we cannot count on that, dream that we have in the, in our sleeping, generally speaking, because these dreams, for the most cases, they have a lot of, false ideas in it, a lot of, problems that you see during your days, and you dream them while you're sleeping. Okay,
yeah.
For the most cases, we cannot rely on our dreams. And as I said, if you, for example, it has been proven for us that that particular dream was accurate one.
How can it be proven?
It requires some kind of ta'bir.
Mm-hmm.
Ta'bir, it means interpretation for that qualified person to do that.
Okay.
And this interpretation, it is not, for example, it is not a job of everybody who claim that I can interpret your dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, you see in this time that many people, they claim that we can interpret and do ta'bir of your dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, many people, they claim to do that. Very simply, they try to interpret your dreams.
Is it a certain branch of knowledge?
Of course, yes. Of course, it is a certain branch of knowledge. And as I said, very rarely people, some qualified scholar, they have this kind of knowledge to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, as I said, the most of our dreams are non-authentic one.
Mm-hmm.
And they are from, they are considered to be from Adghath Ahlam. And, in order to have a Ru'ya Sadaqa, which is accurate beliefs, accurate dreams, it have a lot of conditions that I explain some part of that.
Yeah.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio.
You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Is there any way to affect our dreams, to make it true dreams, that is Ru'ya Sadaqa? Is it a way, for example, I need to perform something, to act upon something, to have my dreams to be good, Ru'ya Sadaqa?
Of course, we have in our collection of the prayers, like Mafatihul Jannah and like many other supplication collections, mm-hmm. They have been explained to us some ways in order to have a Ru'ya Sadaqa. I do not want to explaining, you know, here via this media. For those, I ask those people who want to follow up this discussion and go and search for it. But we have, for sure, some ways in order to have some kinds of, you know, accurate dreams. Mm-hmm. I want to emphasize on this point that most of the dreams, if not all the dreams that we see, some simple people, they are considered to be non-accurate ones.
Yeah. Concerning the main question that we have started the show with, that is, when we see some of the dead people in our dreams and they are sometimes sad or happy, so what can be the reason behind that?
Of course, you know, we have in the verse of Noble Quran talking about the dreams, mm-hmm. and it is one of the signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And maybe Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to indicate to us the day of judgment through these dreams. Mm-hmm. When you see, you know, for example, simply people, they go to sleep and they have some kind of dreams. Mm-hmm. It is some kind of indication for the day of judgment. Okay. True. And in the verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, at the end of verse, he said that, إِنَّ فِي ذَلِكَ لَآيَاتٍ لَقَوْمٍ يَتَفَكَّرُونَ. Talking about the dreams, he said that these are some signs for those people who want to reflect upon that.
Okay.
I just want to say a lot of undiscovered, untrodden, you know, points we have in this regard. We do not have, you know, conclusive ideas about that. And maybe we cannot, you know, a lot of areas that they are undiscovered yet about mm-hmm. the dreams.
Yeah.
We cannot provide many explanation for that.
Okay. So when we see, based on what you say, and when we see a person who has passed away already, when we see him sad or happy, it might not be that important.
Of course, maybe you can do some prayer for him or her, for the deceased one. You can do some kind of prayer, or, for example, you do some kind of sadaqah. You can do a favor for him and to send some kind of reward for that deceased one. Mm-hmm. We have these kind of things in our, you know, collections of the narrations. For example, if you do recite Fatiha and send the reward of that to the deceased one, or, for example, you give some kind of charity and send the reward for that deceased one. Or, for example, you go to the visitation of holy shrine and send the reward and so on and so forth.
Most of the time we see some people that they have dreamed, for example, their dead father or mother who was, let's say, happy or sad, and it affected the way of life that they had. For example, they felt that they themselves, the people who are alive, did something bad that it actually affected them, or they are punished or they are rewarded for whatever they have done in this world. Can this simple interpretation be done by ordinary people, or it really requires a person who has that branch of that sort of knowledge that you have talked about?
Of course, it requires, if you want to interpret the dreams of people and to distinguish whether this dream is accurate one or false one, and to explain the detail of that dreams and doing interpretation, it requires some kind of qualification.
Yeah.
Simple people, I mean ordinary people, they cannot do that. This mm-hmm. is not their job. But as I said, the emphasis is on, for example, sending some reward and doing some recommendation which has been mentioned in the narrations or in the verse of Noble Quran for the deceased one. Mm-hmm. Not to do and to some kind do some kind of innovation here, or for example to try to, you know, do some kind of man-made practices here. These mm-hmm. are not acceptable.
So based on what you say, we cannot look at the dreams like a proof for us. For example, to make some conclusions, to say, okay, my father was happy, it means that he did many good actions in this world, and
or even I myself should be satisfied with whatever I have done